Hello, Brain Fuzz listener. It's Matthew. Joe and I have a special treat for you today. Unlike past episodes, this is a walkthrough of a creative space, noises and all. It's the studio and grounds of sculptor Gordon Chandler. He's partly known for his kimono-style sculptures fashioned from steel drums and other materials. The audio is a bit messy, but that's part of this highly authentic experience. We walk around a bit, and then we sit down for a quieter discussion at the end. The topics drift a bit, so I'll be jumping in and out to provide some context. So yes, that's me on top of any barking dogs, but trust me, it's worth it.
You're listening to Brain Fuzz, the arts, music, and culture podcast with Joe Camusa and Matthew White. Today, Joe and Matthew join sculptor Gordon Chandler at his sprawling rural studio and sculpture parks near Carrollton in West Georgia. They walk, look, talk, and discuss a history in art making that stretches decades, from the first inspiration through Skowhegan and beyond. Practicality plays a part. They wrestle with scale, logistics, repurposing, creative habits, and more. Follow along with images from this visit on Instagram at BrainFuzz Podcast and see show notes at brainfuzzpodcast.com. Now, back to Joe and Matthew with sculptor Gordon Chandler. They're talking a bit about the kimono sculptures and taking a look at his records on the sculptures.
Not an easy idea,
but you know, they're robes, they can be a lot of things. But we're doing these, which is more of an Asian and a little quieter.
And you number each one. What are we up to? 2720?
Yes, sir.
Okay, cool.
Wow.
But that's a long time. It goes back to when I was building wood stoves. And I started numbering those. And when I got up to, I got up to 500. I didn't build that many, but. And then I think when I started numbering my sculpture, I started at 1,000. I'll show you the book.
So do they have a name plus a number?
No. Just well, I usually do it like it.
Because that probably saves a lot of time.
They might go here.
There it is.
So this is pretty cool. I think I lost the first couple pages. These were still wood stoves.
Wow.
1983. 84. These are all wood burners. 84 is wood burners. And then 85, that was about the end of it. I kind of got out of it.
What and got then, you into it?
Just practicality. I built one and put in my shop. I had that old shop downtown. And so here's 1,000. And then I started out with these. There's some sculpture around here that's not in here. But see, we're almost filled up with a cup. So that's all pretty much artwork.
Hey, how you doing,
how
man?
How are you? I'm Matthew.
Matthew, good to meet
this
you.
This is Joe. Good to see you.
Joe, how you doing, man?
All right.
Good. Okay, I'm liking it better already.
Uh-huh.
It's just more interesting. You did this barrel inside out because the inside had such a great.
Yes.
They're actually drums. They're not barrels.
Yeah.
But I call them. And so, anyway, we changed it and we're going to try to put some kind of hem on it. Hemp.
Is it a, kind of, it's a hem?
But it's, I think it's an added piece of
material. I love these details. This is what really.
Is it just there's whatever a, shipping or the
yeah,
contents?
It just stuff? Adds.
You seen them that had all lemon juice?
Yeah, they ship
just
lemon
big drums.
Juice. Yeah.
Huh.
And they do it with everything. The, forget what other. Fruit.
There was like banana puree or something. I've seen those.
Yeah, I guess you got to have
stuff
something
using
that keeps,
everything.
You know?
Yeah,
it doesn't
yeah.
rot in the
right.
ship because some of that stuff would, you know, that's what's. These things are all about commerce and moving materials and you know, business, international business. You go to a deserted island, you know, there's a barrel washes up on uh-huh. shore there. They're everywhere. Ubiquitous.
Well, steel drums.
Yeah. Yeah, and the steel drums on the, Caribbeans.
On this visit, he has some extra hands, and he can use them. It's overwhelming to consider the scale, the size, and the sheer weight of what Gordon works with daily. We walked to another area just off from his scrapyard where some work sit that are clearly repurposed, but from what?
We took apart the gate up at the, you know, the beginning of the driveway. And I'm working on that. I felt like it was too heavy, so I wanted to cut some weight off it. And I got this, and it came back to the shop in a pile. So I took the pile and welded it together as it came together randomly. I didn't really manipulate the composition. I find it.
Yeah.
And I guess identified it as interesting, you know, that moment in time and that. So
that's solution like that you came upon? I'm trying to think, like, you know, looking at your bio, looking at like Skowhegan and all of that. Does that, like, in other words, instead of having to ask 20 questions, is it like, I'm going to make it as I found it?
It's developed over time, but it was always kind of that way. You know, I can see a progression back to the very beginning of and working with materials at hand.
Yeah.
Rather than designing something and then going out and trying to find the materials to make it with, which is, you know, far, far different.
When I finish doing that, I'm done.
But even, you know, like these, this patio is made out of granite countertops that are flipped upside down, rough side up. You know, so I'm constantly recycling. I built a house. I had a slate chalkboards in it and a maple, hard maple basketball court that we put in part of it. So I'm, you know, constantly trying to repurpose these steps. You know, this is a beautiful piece of granite here. That's granite. But the next 2, 3, 4, 5 pieces are the old Carrollton sidewalk that got torn up. But they read like a piece of granite.
Sure.
So I mix that in. Yeah.
The patio he's talking about is exactly that, but you wouldn't know it right away. We walk across these flipped granite countertops and across a narrow footbridge toward the barking dogs near the lower sculpture garden. There, one work sits with macaroni-type elements and then another with map-like features.
This is barking dog gallery over here. These are two good pieces of that, too, that I was talking about. You know, things that just appear, and these were laid out on a pallet, on a wooden pallet. I thought, yeah, okay. I'm not sure I can arrange these materials any better than this. Same as that one. We came back and did a lot of work closing up the ends of those, but they were all laying on a pallet also, coming back. But even, you know, that was an atlas I did. This map, it's, you got a hinge in there. It's all welded off now. And it was just totally from another project.
We walk back toward the scrapyard, where he points out one work. This sparks a conversation on influences, when he hits on something we'd been wondering about on the car ride over. Comparisons with John Chamberlain.
The piece, I did that at college, undergrad. And probably 1970 or something. No.
Syracuse?
Yeah, it's 1970, probably 74.
What was your experience with Skowhegan?
Oh, it's great. I mean, it shaped my life, really. It's so intense and, you know, I don't know what it's like now, but, you know, such great people there, and they had, you know, visiting artists living there, and visiting artists visiting there, and so it was very lively, and everybody showed up, you know, and was doing their thing, so they got to compare notes. And
you did that before?
I did that between my junior and senior year.
That's phenomenal.
Of university, yeah.
I mean,
the sculpture department offered that to me. It was their turn, if it were another year, it would have been in the painting department. So I just happened to... Timing is everything.
I mean, what a perfect time to go.
Yeah, you know, it was like, great.
That's definitely for a younger audience. Right, because it's, what is it, 9 weeks or 12 weeks and you can't leave?
Maybe 12.
I think it's 12.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. It was most of the summer. You know, kind of a little bit Chamberlain-esque, but not.
I'm glad you brought that up. What are your feelings on that? Do you get... We were talking about this on the way. Do you welcome comparisons? Do you...
Sure. You know, I welcome anybody that would actually know John Chamberlain.
Okay. What about Severo?
That's pretty obscure. He's equally as obscure to the population, you know? So anybody that can talk about any of that, I'm interested. Good or bad. You know what I mean? If they say, he reminds me of Chamberlain. Great. I'm happy to hear you know who he is. You've heard him. So, yeah. And, you know, I grew up with, when I was in college, David Smith.
Yep.
You know, and Anthony Caro was just getting on the scene. And those two artists were, you know, they were God to me. They were, you know, the state of the art.
Sure.
And of course, David Smith died in... yeah, I don't know, 64 or something like that. But Anthony Caro, and I just missed him at Syracuse. One of my regrets is I didn't stay at Syracuse another year. They had some big hitters come in there, and they were working on different things. And yeah, Tony Caro is one of them. So
there are a variety of works at this part of the tour. We're in front of large, bright bouquets of industrial detritus. You can follow along with the images on Instagram at BrainFuzz Podcast.
So this is it.
These are wonderful.
And so those are a new quick series I did. I just shipped three of them up to Chicago, and they want one more. So I'm working on another one here. I'll show you. This is the top one.
Who's to know what works will be reworked, how or when? It's clear that his brain is constantly surveying, working, and reworking. He talks of a one-ton floral arrangement and more, including a piece of playground equipment that is currently being reconfigured in his brain into a planter.
How do you feel about reworking things?
Yes, I can feel like I can improve it. I'll do it. You know, it's kind of...
Is it ever complete?
Against my... Sure. I get done with it, especially when it leaves my hand.
Well, yeah, right.
Yeah, I don't have a problem stopping. I have a little problem finishing and maybe starting, but starting's easy.
So you
finishing.
It's that middle period that's all you
There's a podium-like sculpture, which I can't even imagine how it's lifted, and a display with works. Maybe it's a sideboard, a table. Anyway, he describes its surface with a fresh kind of wonder.
But the background, this is an old backboard on my Freightliner truck up there. And I cut it off to put that knuckleboom crane on it. But it's just sublime.
Yes, it is.
All this. So I put it up on this, but I might put four legs under it. It's been in the works for a long time. It's got too much junk on it now, but
thinking that it's like an author?
Yeah, it is kind of like that, or a sideboard, or a table. This is more like a podium here, this piece behind the red chair.
Yes, it is.
And this is one of my favorite pieces from that Prush period.
Yeah.
And it's called Red Rooster. Everybody should do an artwork named Red Rooster. And that's it. And then this is the first piece I did from the bridge in the...
Some works here are derived from parts reclaimed from a large salvaged Georgia bridge, the Rogers Bridge. Again, you can see these and other images on Instagram at BrainFuzzPodcast. We walk over to the area of the property referred to as the crater and go back to the very beginning of his story.
I'm sick of Tubbit. So, Western Mass background?
Well, I was born in Springfield, which okay. is kind of west considered Western Mass.
And then,
I moved into the Berkshires. I really hadn't applied much to school. And I played basketball in high school. And the town selectman actually got the coach of Syracuse over, because he asked me one time what schools I was interested in. I told him Syracuse. And the coach at the time, Coach Roy Danforth, came over and scouted me in my home gym and gave me a free application with his signature on it, you know, which meant let him in, maybe go out and make the freshman team, and maybe he'll stick around. We need people on the freshman team. So I did, and I did go out and make the team, and played for a little bit, and that was it. I was ready to go into the world of art. I felt like they were kind of
opposites.
Yeah, mutually exclusive or something. Which,
how lucky though to have that vision, you know, at that age in terms of art, you know.
Oh, it was high school art room was a huge. That was the best place in high school for me. And I remember I just stood up a piece. Very first piece I ever did was I was probably maybe less than six, and I went in the basement and it assembled a cross, you know, a simple sure. vertical and horizontal. I didn't even know what it meant, or I wasn't particularly. I guess I was in Sunday school at the time. And I can remember Saturday night, I had it put it together crudely. And then I painted it with this shellac that was left over from the house my dad built that we were living in. And I remember the smell of it. It was distinct. And it never dried out. So I was carrying this sticky cross into Sunday school that had this kind of a wonderful, I think it was like, made from linseed oil. This was a house built in the late 40s, I guess. I always say that was my very first sculpture. And then I was always putting stuff together.
It sounds like dad built a house, I'm assuming, handy.
Yeah, he always had a shop in the basement.
There you go.
Hand saws and vices and things. And
so you're a lifer.
So, yeah, this is what I've been doing. And now I continue to do it, and I make sculpture. These are the three pieces from the bridge.
Those are wonderful.
So I had them up against the building where the red chair is. And once again, the setting didn't set them up. It didn't make them pop. But I brought them over here. And then I'm also getting lots of different weather behind them, atmosphere. It's foggy sometimes.
Yeah.
It's... you know, late sunset. It's so. It's pretty been fun. So yeah, this is kind of my driving range here, where I come out and hit golf balls poorly. But I'm on the verge of understanding it.
In the upper sculpture yard, a large Jenga-like sculpture, among a variety of others, sits. Some have traveled quite a ways to rest here a while.
House, but I certainly put it together, and it seems to be a favorite. It's something everybody wants a piece of, like individual. Oh, would you sell some of that stone?
Oh, really?
And people like it generally as a form. And this piece has been on the road a couple times. It went to Bonnaroo.
Oh, cool.
And so I had to rebuild it, cut it apart, and then make it bolt together to get it in the back of the truck.
That always blows my mind.
And then I took in Rusty up here. Rusty had, he went up there. He was at
Burning Man. These jacks here were at Burning Man. It was a piece. I think I built this piece like this, and it goes back pretty good. And then I built that base for it to go on. I think it's more successful without the big base on it.
Interesting. Yeah, I can see that.
That's upside down. I actually got it that way, and I was having a hard time handling it with that trunk. I get it.
You got the Jim Dines in here?
Jim Dine was probably one of the main influences for me doing those kimonos.
Yeah.
The robes, you know. I actually, my ex-wife and I had a big Jim Dine print of a robe. He called them robes. And so that was, you know, it was big print, maybe 4 or 5 foot high and colorful. So that was, but I always give him credit for that. Me living with one of his robes. So this is a piece I bring you, math, and my graduate. And it was repurposing the building that was next door to the sculpture studio. And they were tearing it down, and I was rebuilding it. And it sat out in front of the sculpture studio for a number of years. And I went back in this and loaded it up and brought it here. It just got stood up here this last week.
Really?
It's been laying down ever since.
It's wonderful.
But both this one, there's another one over there at the edge of the driveway. I call them crossroads. And they're sort of, again, about that cross that, my first piece.
Oh, yes, yes.
And so I relate to it that way. I'm not sure, you know. But I look at those jacks. They're kind of that same thing, too, you know, with the crossroad, the crossing, the center point. Just try to find them.
How do you feel about something like this sculpture that was in front of the library? How do you feel when something like this weathers?
This one's great because it was painted in safety red, so it oil enamel. So it would be super easy to repaint as it needed.
Yeah.
Now, I could also expect, as some of my big benches, expect somebody, if they're out in the distance, to do graffiti on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which, I'm okay with that. It sort of puts a life to it. I don't know.
Well, we got our steps in. I'm glad to park it back in the main building to sit with Gordon, where we look back on his history, his creative habits, and more.
Going at this since 80s. 80.
Well, kind of full-time since the mid-80s, yeah. Or nearly. I did a show at Piedmont Park. They used to do this bathhouse show. And it was, I think it was 4 or 5 artists by invitation to do this show. And it was a real turning point in my, I just built this nice house out here on Open Creek. And then I had an opportunity to do that. And that was the year before. I was still building some wood burning stoves. And I had a great show there and sold a bunch of stuff out of the bathhouse, which is kind of unheard of. I was trying to think of the other people that were in it. Benjamin Jones, you know, mm-hmm. who he is? Mm-hmm. And who graduated from West Georgia College. It wasn't Herb Creasy. It was the other guy, James Herbert.
Yeah, from UGA?
Yeah, that was it. And then I don't remember who the other people were. It seemed like there was maybe 4 or 5. But that was a real turning point for me. And there was a couple of Atlanta galleries that wanted me to show with them. So that started that. And I ended up going with Joe Langford at, which was really more of a furniture gallery. And then I did a Coconut Grove show, and that was maybe 80,
89 or something, and hauled a whole truckload of stuff down there. And what's his name? O.K. Harris in Atlanta, in New York.
Yeah.
What was his name? The guy that started it. Good old guy. Had a cigar shop in the front of the gallery. I'll think of it in a minute. And anyway, he was the judge of the show, and I did well. I got that best of show there. And then my dealer up in Chicago, Ann Nathan, happened to be walking around. And she came down and visited, and she and I went to, I picked her up at the airport, and she and I went up to Howard Finster. And she had a huge collection of Finster's early stuff.
Really?
Important stuff.
So way ahead of the curve.
Yeah, and she had a lot of stuff. And so, anyway, that was when Finster was still alive. And we sat on the porch with Howard Finster, and that was very cool. And then she came, and I think went through Carrollton. I was still at my old shop, and showed her what I was doing. And so she brought me on board, and there was a big develop in her galleries too. But she was great, and I was with her for 20, 30 years or something.
Wow. Time.
Yeah, we had a great relationship.
Do you think that still exists? I mean, except on like the really high level, you know, where galleries can really grow.
You know, Chicago is a great market. And she started in a small, kind of a loft space. I don't think I even saw that space. And then she moved to another space. And I don't know if it was her third space or not, but the whole building burned. She had two pieces of mine, and it was a total loss back in, must have been the 90s.
Wow.
And I was reimbursed for the pieces that were lost. And she took care of her artists. Not all the galleries in that building took care of their artists as well. But she was great. And then she went to the merchandise mart for a few years and then found a new space where she was for some time. In Superior, Huron, or I don't know where it was, but yeah, I don't know. You know, we had great collectors, and I think the collectors have thinned out a lot. So I think that's part of what drove those galleries. And you know, I don't know what's going to become. You know, people, you guys are the exception that you're paying attention and seeing what's out there and what kind of artwork. But I'm afraid there's not really another generation or two more generations that even see those things. Everybody's on, you know, on a digital
phone. Yeah.
You have so many resources at your disposal, and yet we're stuck with cat videos and you know, and Joe does some cat pictures and cat videos, and that's fine.
Just to juice the algorithm.
But I do wonder. But it is amazing to me that you have all these resources at hand, and yet it's a short term kind of memory now, rather than a long.
Well, you know, I spoke of it earlier that some sculpture is a liability.
Sure.
For any number of reasons, and so is art. You get, you know, something that's either really valuable. Or
yeah, you got to insure it.
Insurance isn't any big thing, but you know, if you're a person that has a small space or has a tendency to move around a lot, you know, that those things are difficult to deal with, especially outdoor. And I haven't ever been one to go after commissions so much, which now hurts me because I don't have a track record of doing commissions. You know, there's people that made careers on largely commissions. And, you know, I was doing those benches for a while, and benches are real palatable. That's how a lot of those images came, was that, you know, I was doing, when I showed up in Carrollton in 1975, you know, I started renting that warehouse, $50 a month, and started making sculpture. And, you know, I was doing this welded steel sculpture right out of university, and you know, people were scratching their heads, like, what is it? What does it mean? What does it do? What's it for? And, you know, I started thinking about that. Like, what? Yeah, well, those are good questions, actually. So I started doing that, and I think my imagery changed coming out of that. And you know, I actually had one piece in particular. It was a big sphere out of these geared rings and about 6 foot diameter. And I hung it on a telephone pole out in front of my shop. And somebody came by and asked me what it is. And I said, it's an ornament. And that was like the light bulb went on and it worked for that person. Oh, it's an ornament. It looked kind of like a, you know, a Christmas tree ornament or something. But and that piece ended up selling and going to somebody's home, you know, a block or two from my shop in downtown Carrollton, which is pretty unheard of. So that was a turning point. And then I started doing, you know, the chairs. I did a chair because I needed some chairs out in the woods where I was living. And I started to do that for my own sake. And then I guess I started to see some possibilities. Did that bathhouse show. And I had a bunch of chairs in that and a bunch of those sold. So I was off to the races. And the kimonos are kind of like that. People hang kimonos in their house. People hang dead deer heads in their house. People hang quilts. People hang...
When did the kimonos first happen?
Somewhere around 2000, maybe. Okay. 2001, somewhere in there. Yeah.
And they have a popularity internationally.
Yeah, I've got them around the world. And they keep changing, like I showed you in some variations here. Pals. Those two in the middle went to Burning Man last year, and they got all dusted.
Oh, that's...
that's the finish on them.
Well, so that's part of the story that you say that works have, is like if someone vandalizes something, or if that...
Yeah, you know, to a point. Part of the story. To a point. But we're doing a show in LaGrange next year about... Burning Man,
uh-huh.
And there's a photographer that they want me to go back this year. It's just so hard to get there. It's crazy. So I don't know that I'm... But anyway, so I got a friend here that goes every year, and he took those and brought them back. And, you know, it's a sculpture show. That's how it started. And they're trying to maintain that. That it's, a feast for the eyes.
Well, I think, you know, going back a second when you were talking about, you know, how everything's gone digital, yet it's so much art these days, it has to be like an experience. It's all about entertaining people, I think, more so than, I mean, some people still want to, you know, acquire things for their living space.
But in a way, that's about entertainment, too.
Sure, but I think it's more like, because I'm thinking just the logistics, more, the work of, like, trucking this stuff up somewhere, again, so people can basically take selfies and go, isn't that great? And then they move on.
Yeah.
You know, I mean... I guess it's better than nothing, but
yeah,
it is...
Like the background, yeah.
It's real. I mean, Anish Kapoor, I mean, the amount of engineering into those things, and you think about what it really is the equivalent of, like, again, we keep going to digital, but the ubiquitous bathroom selfie photo of somebody.
Well, I've been to the Bean in Chicago there. I mean, it's a remarkable sculpture.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm sure I took a picture of it, but if it wasn't about... me posing in front of it.
That's the weird thing for me in consuming this is the person in front of the work.
Yeah.
I can't get my head around that. For some reason that I don't... I understand maybe being in the work or around the work, but so much it's about the person in front of the work rather than...
What about like Lee Friedlander, the photographs with like the reflections in the mirrors and the glass?
Okay, that's good. That's good. I'm just talking day to day when you're consuming.
Well, but if you think of it more experientially, in like I said, if the tree falls in the forest, but if you know that person is an integral part of the artwork, that's the artwork in most cases was made to have a person or 100 people in front of it. So it's really activated. That's when it's at full speed, kind of.
Do you think that that's
becoming... I think what you're talking about too is you know, the person of me in front of that. Or I just heard of somebody that went to the Musée d'Orsay, and they went and looked at the Impressionist art, and they said, okay, I've seen the Impressionists, let's go. So it was like, you know, and there's a thing, my friend did his PhD dissertation on it, and it's about, you know, we only know what we already know. We only know what we have experienced. We can't really know more than that until we learn more. So we're really limited by our
experience.
Our past and who we are at this moment, and then I guess we can add on to it little by little. And then the next time we see something like that, or so you know, we are.
Well, that speaks to your. You were talking about the piece early on when you first moved here. I mean, I think people have to see it and say, "What the hell is that?"
Right, you had to connect. But, you know, what was I doing before that? I was, you know, probably looking through my Anthony Caro catalog or my David Smith books or, sure. You know, trying to figure out what I'm going to do and how I can distinguish myself amongst these giants.
You especially know? You were saying that was like 70s, right? Early 70s and thinking of still the crushing weight of abstract expressionism.
Sure.
You know? I mean, you think of that era especially, and I love that work, but I mean, we mentioned like DeSevero earlier, but like, you know, Orange, what is it, Corten Steel, those giant skulls. I mean, that to me is like so, like a Barcelona chair. I mean, it's such an iconic piece for that kind of time, but I wonder if that kind of winds up pigeonholing, you know, that people just kind of want almost replicas. Did you find that?
Yeah, and I've tried very hard to avoid that. And I know a lot of other people don't resist that or see something, and it's like, oh, I can make that. And they do, you know, and it's nice. But, I, you know, if I go to somebody who's collecting it and I say, who's that piece by? And they go, this is so. Or I say, oh, that looks like a
cool. Yeah.
And then they tell me who it's by, and I go, well, that was a total rip. You know, just theft by taking.
The temptation is just too great, I guess.
Well, it's kind of, you like the piece, you like the form, you like the material, so I'm just going to go ahead and make it. But, and, you know, I'm sure I've taken ideas. I take images off the internet and put them in a file or something. And
sure.
I reflect on those. But
You're not blatantly copying.
No, well, I'm trying to do something in my own language.
Sure.
At my own hand.
Well, that was one question I had, because, I mean, I was looking over your...
Even though I got help, I got extra hands.
Cool, you would need it. But thinking about, like you were talking about... you know, connecting with the past and all of that, and I'm just trying to think in terms of like professional practices, like how or what advice would you give to artists? I'm not even going to say aspiring, but just people that are just in a space making stuff, thinking about stuff, like weathering trends and dealing like with waiting things out, because you know sometimes it's not the time for big paintings or big sculpture.
The number one thing in my college professor told me, he said, you know, the hardest part about being a sculptor is sticking with it, is continuing to do it and not giving up on it. And, you know, that's perseverance. And Henry Miller he wrote about perseverance and how it can overcome all sorts of shortcomings, you know. So if you keep doing it, you got to learn something, right?
Right.
And you got to hopefully keep making it better.
But I think the commitment, you know, I'm bitching about sometimes moving, you know, 6x8 foot paintings. That's nothing compared to this. I mean, in terms of having the shop space, the warehouse space, the space to think, you've got a wonderful collection of all kinds of art here. I mean, that's a huge commitment to saying, yeah, I'm going to just keep working.
Well, you know? And that's kind of where my galleries, you know, I had... a couple, three more wonderful galleries, and the people, Fake Gold being one of them in Atlanta, and you know, they just got out of the, they aged out. She's 91 years old. And, you know, she's still in the art business, but doing it from home. And I'm, you know, I'm kind of happy just building my sculpture yards here and trying to keep them mowed and look. And I'm still waiting for maybe you guys or, you know, some people come by who appreciate it. Because, you know, I'm, this is like the final frontier. This is far west Georgia.
Are you getting students out here, even if it's field trips?
No.
Do you want that?
Yeah, sure. I would. It would, even from West Georgia, they don't. They won't venture out. It's too far to go.
Because I mean, I'm thinking this is like an MFA working here. I'm sure in terms of the.
And I have had students from there that worked here, but as far as undergraduates or students, you know, a lot of people say, "Oh yeah, I'd like to come out," but you know, it doesn't happen. I give them a card, give them a number, and. It's just about stretching out. You got to be curious.
You mentioned going
turn
to
the rocks over,
mm-hmm. going to Paradise Gardens and that sort of thing. You know, like I think that is an older idea. You know, like the road trip. Let's go up to Finster's place. You know, that was a rite of passage, especially since REM kind of helped put Finster on the map in this state. You know, nowadays people are like, why would you bother? You just look at it on your phone, you know, and you're just like, you're not getting it, you know. But,
yeah, or looking at a painting, you know.
Oh, sure.
It's so rich and, you know, I always talk about this one, in this sfumato, you know, which was the Da Vinci form of perspective. Mm-hmm. And it's all about sfumato. Oh, I really enjoyed it. And I'll show you some other pieces that I've collected.
That is wonderful.
I think really better artists, though, collect.
Well, I think it's important.
They have to have, what are you feeding on?
Well, that's right. And I think it opens up the door of commerce, of trade.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, if you expect people to take yours, you need to find others that you want to live with or that you're willing to trade for or put money on.
How do you deal with...
And I think that increases energy.
Sure, I agree. I think just getting things in and out the door, you need movement. How do you deal with, like, there's... separation is big for me. Like I have a tiny studio behind the house. I've got my work up. It's kind of a storage thing. I'd rather not have to look at it, but it's like, what's, you know, it kind of needed that in the house. Don't really want to see my work. Do you ever feel like you got to get, there's no way of getting away from your work here. It's everywhere.
Right.
And you're able
That's
to,
no problem. Yeah.
You're
I don't,
just, you're
I,
able to just,
well, like, you know, the other, I can be, sleeping or nodding out or somewhere completely different, and I go, oh, boom, that's what I need to do with that piece. There's a piece of shape or something I'm working on or something I'm stumped on, but that idea will just flow.
How many acres is this?
Sorry?
How many acres?
Two.
Okay, so 2 acres, and when we got here, we were walking around, and I'm just thinking, like, the entire 2 acres is your studio. And something tells me you know where everything is.
Well, I don't, but you know, and then I encroach all the way around. My neighbors are great about letting me be on their property and keep a mowed and hit golf balls.
How do you see things changing? Like I said, you've done this since the 80s. You've seen decades now. I see it as a way of life rather, I mean, you're lucky if you can make it a career.
Well, it's what I do. I started when I showed up in Carrollton in 1975. I was doing carpentry, you know, and I barely knew much about that. But, was involved in building houses. And I guess the whole way was in order to build a studio to make sculpture, to make my art. That was, you know, and the wood stoves were that way, too. It was a way of... you know, getting equipment and making some money and you know, putting back into the business. So I had those expectations and didn't veer. But, you know, heck, you have a family. You know, there's a lot of interruptions that are out there. You know, you can get a job that pays every week. You can get, you know, futures. You can do all that. So many people walk away from that. It's, you know, you're working without a net in a lot of ways. So, you know, what are you going to do, especially to begin with?
I think people are not willing to accept that, though, working without a net. There isn't a net.
Right. Well, I, you know, I was able to do that because my overhead was really low.
But you found a way to do it.
Yeah.
And you said earlier it was the labor is the thing that would
have been the most. Well, hands. More hands on deck, you know. Yeah. And
I can't imagine with work like this.
Yeah.
Did you work on your own?
Sure. A lot of time. I can remember coming into the old shop in the middle of the night. I'd wake up and couldn't sleep or whatever. And I'd go in and start working and beating on hammering things and grinding it. 2 a.m. or something.
Really?
And you know, I don't really have, I wake up in normal hours now, but, you know, there really isn't any hours or weekend or, you know, it doesn't
You're
really
never
matter.
Off.
Yeah, my girlfriend gets excited because I don't take weekends off, you know. I'm apt to work at golf during the week, so. But, anyway, yeah, so I, you know, time doesn't matter that much. And so anyway, I'm just plugging along, and I'm at 70. I mean, you know, what am I going to go another 10 years here working and producing? And I got good ideas. I got a lot to do. But we'll see.
It's amazing the amount of just watching you. You're constantly, that brain's constantly turning.
Well, sure.
Yeah. And I mean, and even sitting and having dinner,
right.
I noticed.
Somebody was just, maybe it was on one of the podcasts or something, talking about that. I just heard that lately about sort of that, it doesn't stop.
Yeah, you're always it doesn't thinking, stop. And that's one of the curses of being, I think, an artist.
Maybe it was something else. And they were saying even when you're down and, you know, clearing your mind, you're still working. That was what it was about. It was about work. Always working.
Yeah, that we repeat that, like most of our podcasts. That comes up almost every time.
It's not a burden.
It is. It's life.
Yeah.
But I think the notion of like never being off—that's one thing. Like, you know, again, people, oh, you're so lucky, you get to, you know, paint all day or whatever their thought is. But when you're doing it every day, like, there is, you don't retire from art.
Understand that. We've heard people say
I don't
say
go
this.
On vacation, really. I go to my studio. I've worked my whole, you know, like, to get to that point, to have a studio, to go work, why the hell am I going here and there? And anything. It's like getting rid of the distractions. But I do think there's a little bit of there's a price in terms of like sanity and finding, you know. But I mean, a lot of artists, I think that's the deal. Like, to be able to be solitary, you at least have, you need extra hands. But like most, you know, painters or hermits, you know. But I think there's a slippery slope where too much of it, and you're, you know, ready for a pink room.
Yeah.
Brain fuzz, deep moments.
Gordon, thank you so much.
It's amazing.
It's been fun.
My brain is spinning.
Talking about myself.
I always love coming out here and spending time. I do. I really do. I enjoy it.
Yeah,
I'm so glad.
Well, it's a gift.
The factory.
Thank you.
The factory.
The shop.
Brain Fuzz is available on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and elsewhere. Find show notes and links at brainfuzzpodcast.com. Engage in the dialogue via Instagram at BrainFuzzPodcast or hashtag anywhere on social with BrainFuzzPodcast. AI support provided by Play.ht and Melabytes. Thanks to our listeners, our donors, patrons, partners, communities, supporters, and stakeholders everywhere.
So, yeah, this is kind of my driving range here where I come out and hit golf balls poorly.
I'm on the verge of understanding it.